Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled The War on Drugs, a 1990s Debate on Prohibition versus Legalization. Recorded in 1994, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, hosts a discussion about the war on drugs with former Cato Institute Executive Vice President David Bowes, former Dean of National College of Criminal Defense Emmett Colvin, FBI Special Agent Buck Ravel, and DEA Special Agent Phil Jordan. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
U.S. News and World Report in last month's issue estimated the annual direct and indirect costs of crime in America at $674 billion per year. Of that total, $40 billion is estimated for drug abuse, and another $39 billion is spent on police protection. This program will offer you at least two very contrasting opinions about what our war on drugs is doing and its success. Specifically, we will answer and attempt to answer whether the war can be won, and if so, at what price in both dollars and civil liberties. Now, joining us to begin the debate are two award-winning law enforcement officials. I'd like to start on my right with Buck Ravel. He is a special agent in charge, Dallas Division of the FBI. Buck, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dennis.
And sitting next to Buck is Phil Jordan, Special Agent in Charge, Dallas Field Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Phil, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Let me ask you, Phil, this war on drugs is being talked about all the time. Are we winning the war on drugs?
Well, let me say that we are winning some significant battles out there in the battlegrounds. To ultimately win this war, we need to change the attitudes of the American public. You know, we need a strong law enforcement with strong demand reduction type programs. By that I mean, you know, not programs that are going to benefit our children and make them aware that drugs are not good for your bodies.
So you're talking about something other than just law enforcement, all kinds of programs. We have people in our audience who run those kind of programs. Is that what you're talking about?
A strong law enforcement with strong demand reduction programs, you know, the treatment, prevention, and most important, education.
Okay, so there are a lot of fronts on the war against drugs. Your side of it is strictly law enforcement. Now, when I ask you if you're winning, you said you're winning some battles. Does that mean that you're really not winning the war, but if you win enough battles, you will win the war? Or how do you mean that?
Well, again, I'm trying to make a very...
You're trying to hedge, Phil, basically, is what you're trying to do. Let's face it.
No, what I'm saying here is that law enforcement alone cannot win this battle. All right, that's a given. We need the help of the American public, the American people, the students, everybody, in order to win this war, and by changing attitudes, by strong education, strong prevention. And we do have, by the way, a demand reduction program within DEA, as well as the FBI, in terms of educating our children.
I like that. Buck, how about you? Are we winning the war on drugs?
I think we are holding our own, winning a number of battles. We're breaking apart major organizations. But if you look at it from a zero-sum game, no, we're not about to stop drugs as a law enforcement effort. We are certainly, I think, making it difficult to obtain drugs, but we're not able to stop them. And I agree with Phil 100%. Education, the treatment, and rehabilitation must be a major ingredient to an effective war on drugs.
Okay, thanks. Let me introduce the other two panelists on the end. Emmett Colvin is a Dallas lawyer and a member of the Texas Criminal Defense Lawyers Hall of Fame, the former dean of the National College of Criminal Defense. Dean Colvin, you are one of the best-known criminal attorneys in the country. And on a program that we did some weeks back on civil asset forfeiture, you asked, and sitting here in the audience, you asked, why is it we can't look at what we're doing with more reason? So I ask you this question. Are we winning the war on drugs, and in fact, is it winnable?
No, I don't think the war on drugs is winnable. You know, what caused me to come into the law more than 50 years ago was all the reason that was available. And now I find I'm facing emotion. Emotion from law enforcement, from prosecutors, from defense lawyers. You can't decide anything emotionally. You can't say, well, let's put them in jail and throw away the key. That's emotional. It has nothing to do with reasoning. And yet we're in a situation now where it's costing us $150 billion a year on drug and alcohol abuse. And I include drug and alcohol and smoking.
As all in the same thing, basically?
Well, not all the same, but most of the deaths are caused by drug and alcohol. I mean, alcohol and smoking.
Exactly.
Not drugs. Marijuana, there hasn't been one recorded death. It really, that is the first drug I think we should think about decriminalizing.
So you're gonna suggest to the people watching this program and the people in this audience that we ought to decriminalize some of these drugs. Is that true?
Very cautiously, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen when you let the ball go. It should be done in a very controlled manner and in limited areas. We must experiment. But when the Surgeon General said we must study it, hell, everybody was jumping all over. Just for saying, let's study it. When you turn away from reason and knowledge, you have lost it. That's it.
All right. Thank you. And our last panel member, David Bowes from the Cato Institute. David is the Executive Vice President of that institute, located in Washington, D.C. And for those of you watching this program, you may know that Cato is a public policy research foundation looking at primarily market solutions to the problems of America. David, welcome to Texas and welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You've heard what our law enforcement officials have said. They have hedged their bet a bit, saying that they hope to win the war. They realize they're only a small part of it. But I want to focus on that part of it for a moment, particularly the part that has to do with the actions that we're taking in the court systems and through law enforcement. Are we going to win the war on drugs that way, in your estimation?
A couple of minutes ago, I felt like I was back in high school hearing President Nixon say there's light at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam. We won some battles in Vietnam, but we never won the war. We've won some battles in this drug war, but we're not going to win this war. Tens of millions of people use drugs. We're spending $15 billion a year to fight it, a lot more money than we ever spent to fight alcohol prohibition, and crime rates are going through the roof. That's the biggest problem.
Well, you wrote a book, or actually edited a book, that's written by several different people. It's called The Crisis in Drug Prohibition. Now, in this book, several people wrote that there were effects of the war on drugs that were perhaps even more negative than the drugs themselves. Tell us what some of those things are that you see as negative effects of what we're doing presently.
Just like in the 1920s, there were bad effects of alcohol, there were additional bad effects of alcohol prohibition, and we decided we can't get rid of the bad effects of alcohol, but we can get rid of the problem of prohibition. Today, there are bad effects of drugs, but there are more bad effects of drug prohibition.
Give us
an idea. The biggest one is crime. Half the crime in major cities is a result of addicts trying to pay for a habit that would be easily affordable if it was legal. I live in the middle of Washington, D.C. The big reason that it's too dangerous for me to walk a few blocks away to have a drink, go to a bookstore, is the war on drugs. The more dramatic kind of crime that we hear about are the black market murders. You know, when two liquor dealers have an argument, they don't go shooting each other. They go sue each other in court. But when two drug dealers have an argument, they have to shoot each other because they don't have any recourse to the lawyer. They can't call Dean Colvin and say, this guy's cheated me and I want to sue him in court. You do that in any other business. You can't do it in the drug business. And that's why cities from Richmond to Fresno to St. Paul set murder rates last year.
Phil, how would you react to that?
Well, you know, he touched on alcohol here. If we knew about alcohol, I mean, if we knew everything that alcohol has done to this country, I mean, would we be legalizing alcohol in this day and age? You know, I think he answered his own question in that respect. But yes, there's a direct correlation between drugs and crime out there. And how much more crime would we have if that the drug culture was all over the place?
Well, one of the things that we talked about prior to the program, Buck, and you and I talked about this, we said something about what would be the impact on crime if, in fact, we didn't have the drug aspect to it. What do you think would happen with crime?
Well, from my personal experience with drug addicts, I don't think they're going to hold down jobs. I don't think they're going to be capable of performing in society, and they're still going to have money to support themselves and to feed themselves and to have the kind of things, the automobiles and all of the accoutrements that go with it. So where are they going to get that money? They can't hold a job. They're still going to commit crimes, but these crimes are going to be even worse because they're going to be more addicted to these drugs. I think this is a false solution. We're not going to solve a social issue by simply making it available on demand on the street. Obviously, we cannot say that, all people are going to be prohibited by continuing the enforcement of laws from gaining drugs, but there is a certain percentage that will, in fact, not become involved with drugs because it is illegal. And we're going to, in fact, say, it's all right, go ahead and do it. So I don't think we're going to reduce the crime rate. I think we're going to increase it.
David?
Well, in the first place, we're not going to say, it's all right, go ahead and do it. We're going to say we're not going to use the criminal law to punish you if you do it. And that is a big distinction. In this society, it's legal to smoke cigarettes. It's legal to buy Hustler magazine. It's even legal to buy and read the Communist Manifesto. I don't think we're saying any of those things are a good idea. So in a free society, something being legal doesn't mean the government's recommending it. But more importantly, Buck says drugs would be available on the street. Well, I don't know what street he lives on, but all the streets I've been on recently, drugs are available. The drug war is not preventing people from getting drugs. And I think that's something we have to remember when we talk about this. The question is not, shall we have drugs available or shall we not? The question is, shall we have drugs available and spend $15 billion a year arresting a million people, or shall we have drugs available through a legal, regulated marketplace?
Dean?
I think you have to stop first and analyze just what drugs we're talking about. We're talking about primarily marijuana, heroin, and cocaine. Marijuana, there's never been a recorded death from indulging in marijuana. If I were to select a drug that I could experiment with, if I were Big Ernie and just said, let me pick out a drug, that would be the drug that I would decriminalize. First place, they're not winning the war on it. They know that. I think Kentucky is a good example where they went in with to eradicate the drug. All they did was just move the drugs all over the state of Kentucky, and they got a hell of a lot of community support from the people drumming up business for the growers of marijuana. But marijuana is not really a habit-forming drug. Of all the drugs, of the three, that's the one I think we should focus on first.
Okay, Buck, now you seem to have a problem with that.
Well, first place, there's been a lot of deaths from the use of marijuana. You just don't, it's not from the standpoint of an overdose. It's from the standpoint of accidents, automobiles, and also other types of violent activities that occur because a person is under the influence of marijuana.
But you can't point that to marijuana.
Well, you do it with alcohol. But the point of it is that this is the entry drug into the illicit use of narcotics. Marijuana, about 95% of the time, has been the drug that was used to enter into both cocaine and heroin use. It has become much more potent over the past couple of decades. The THC content is increasing, and it does have adverse health impact. Now, if we were going to say, of all the drugs, which one would you legalize? Certainly, it would be marijuana.
I understand.
But is it really in the public's best interest to go ahead and give this entry drug essentially open market availability?
Okay, I'm going to go to this guy here in just one second. But David, at first you were kind of nodding there about why is marijuana more potent today for
he's
one reason. Does
us.
That have anything to do with it? Pardon me?
He's agreeing with us.
Oh, he's agreeing with us.
Well, I agree with that.
I don't know why I didn't see it that way. Maybe it was.
I think that's absolutely right. Marijuana is more potent these days, and the problem is what we call the iron law of prohibition. The more intense the law enforcement, the more potent the drugs become. During alcohol prohibition, they did a much better job of cracking down on beer than on spirits. So you saw people moving from beer to spirits. That was probably not a good thing. In today's drug prohibition, the most bang for the buck is the harder drugs. So you see people moving, dealers in particular, from marijuana to cocaine to crack. Maybe we wouldn't have this more potent marijuana if we didn't have drug prohibition. People would be able to buy weaker forms. They'd use coca tea instead of cocaine. Look at the difference right now in the legal market and the illegal drug market. In the legal market, we're seeing the lowest consumption of spirits ever. People are moving to beer and light beer and wine cooler and low-tar cigarettes. But in the illegal drug markets, because of the iron law of prohibition, we see the drugs getting stronger and stronger.
Thanks.
I was hoping that the discussion was going to be, as Mr. Colvin said, a rational one using reason. And I think we need a referee in here with a whistle that every time somebody says something that's not quite rational, we ought to blow a whistle and say, wait a minute, let's investigate that point. But let me make this point about the consequences of our actions. Government's job, I would think, should be to inform us what the consequences are of using a particular substance, be it alcohol, what it'll do to you, the effects, nicotine, what those effects will do, drinking too much caffeine, what those effects will do. Let me make the decision on what I want to use. Don't treat me like a child or any of the rest of the free Americans able, supposedly able to make decisions for ourselves. Now, I'm in my late 40s. I grew up in the 60s. I had the opportunity to try many of the drugs we're discussing today.
Did you inhale? This is an important point in public policy today.
If I decide to run for president, I will deny I ever said it. but of course, the first drug I was ever introduced to in college, and I'll bet anybody of my age group probably experienced the same thing, was something called a diet pill. And it was used to stay awake at night, to focus on your studies. So, and it did. It would speed up your metabolism, but it had a terrible side effect, one of them being a bad depression when you came down off of it. That today is called speed or amphetamine. I wouldn't come close to taking that kind of substance today. Now, let me make just one other quick point. By making a certain group of drugs illegal, we have created a $60 billion a year industry for all the bad guys in the world, all the misfits and all the outlaws. They now have a way to function in our society and have money coming in, tax-free money, on top of that, where they can buy guns, they can create their turf wars, and it's a wonderful thing for them, it's a wonderful thing for our police forces, because then they can come to us and say, we need more money to fight this crime. And in the meantime, we in the middle are losing our incomes, losing our safety, and I think there needs to be a more reasonable approach, as Mr. Colvin has stated.
Well, it's obvious to me that he doesn't have a strong opinion about it. So, sir, would you mind coming up here? Come on, I'll take you and then you.
My name is Tim Timmons. As a lawyer who's both prosecuted drug cases and defended drug cases during a period of about 35 years, I'm interested to know, and I think the question probably will be directed to Buck Revelle, because the FBI keeps statistics on nearly everything I can think of. Are there any statistical studies available that are definitive on the impact on the incidence of criminal activity and our addiction in those countries in which drugs, hard drugs, or all drugs, have been decriminalized and de facto legalized, for comparison, so that we know the impact and the effect should we have decriminalization.
Okay, stay with us here just a minute. Go ahead, Buck, do you know of anything?
Well, decriminalization has occurred in the Netherlands and to some extent in the United Kingdom and in Denmark, although the United Kingdom has reimposed very stringent restrictions, and in Denmark they have some certain areas where drugs can be utilized, but they do not allow their open sale. Most of their experience has been that they have to come back and reimpose some restrictions. We had people going to the Netherlands from all over Europe that were engaged in conduct that was very detrimental to the people of the Netherlands. They themselves are reconsidering whether or not drugs should be freely available within their own society.
What about in the area of treatment of addiction? Has that increased, if you know, in those countries?
The cost of treatment in the Netherlands in particular has gone up very substantially during this period of experiment. I don't know. I don't have the figures at hand. They are available through the National Institute of Justice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Buck. Yes, sir. Just come right out here if you don't mind.
I work for the Boys and Girls Club in inner city Dallas, and we see an awful lot of families that are just being torn apart, parents that are on drugs that are not being supportive of the family. And if we legalize it, I just see that as getting worse more and more parents using it. That really concerns me when we already have such a major problem with it, children being ignored and abused because of their parents' drug habits.
David?
There's no question that drugs can do terrible things to individuals and families. So can alcohol. I don't know if anybody else agrees with Phil. I can't imagine outlawing alcohol just because of all the terrible things that happen from alcohol. We tried that. It didn't work very well. There's already a terrible problem with people using drugs in our society with drug prohibition. I don't see any good evidence that that problem would get worse if drugs were legalized. The problem is, right now, Drugs are being sold on school playgrounds by 13-year-old pushers. You don't see that happening with alcohol. You don't see that happening very much in legal markets. So I would rather think that drugs were being sold through regulated, licensed liquor stores to adults, recognizing that that won't be a perfect way of keeping them out of the hands of kids, than to have 13-year-old pushers taking them to playgrounds.
Well, I think there has been some evidence that it probably will go up, and I kind of find it kind of ironic that we're talking about almost banning cigarettes, which are supposed to be legal because of their health risk, at the same time when we're talking about finally legalizing drugs. I find that kind of ironic.
I'm not talking about banning cigarettes, and I guarantee
the city council and everyone else and the president, I mean, it's all over the country. And,
I guarantee you, when we ban cigarettes, I will be back on this show 5 years from now telling you about the terrible crime problems that the cigarette smuggling trade has created. You try to take cigarettes away from Americans, and Americans will commit crimes in order to get them.
Sharon?
My name's Sharon Scott. I'm a marriage and family therapist. And Dennis, I'm really concerned that history is being distorted here. If we look back to the early 1900s, not only did we have cocaine and heroin legal in our country, but in 1916, that's when we declared it illegal because it rose more than any other time prior to that. If we look at what has gone on in Japan, if we look at what has gone on in Egypt, when we look at what has gone on in China, where they did not have some of these drugs illegal for many years because of the problem of addiction and crime rising, they then made those drug legals. And in our own country, Alaska, quite some time back, made small amounts of marijuana legal if it was for your own personal use. And you could even grow it, and it was legal in the state of Alaska. And because all marijuana usage in Alaska increased after they made it legal, because every other drug available increased in Alaska during that period of time, Alaskans revolted. And I know many of these people, and I wrote letters with them helping their government to change the laws, and they made even small amounts of marijuana illegal again in the state of Alaska. So we have proven failure in our own country of what we're talking about. We need to research.
Dean Colvin and David, take it.
I think it's very critical if we start decriminalizing any drug. It's going to have to be done in a controlled situation. With a drug, you must, if you release the ceiling on a drug, you must have treatment centers ready and available. Now, we've got 100,000 people trying to get into clinics right today, and they can't get in. Back when we had the Harrison Act back, I believe that was in 1922-23, we had at least 40 clinics available to people, but we don't have enough treatment. Now, we have some minor programs, such as Weed and Seed and that type of thing, but we don't have treatment centers.
But all research shows when we make these physically dependent drugs legal, they increase in usage. And we're also telling the youth of America, many of them, who some of them are here today, they're involved in peer helping groups, and that have been told that chemicals are harmful to their body. And in our country, laws have been made, in my opinion, to not only protect myself, but to protect other people.
Now, on what basis do you say there's an increase? How do you know that?
An increase in drug use.
I mean, she says that all kinds of studies show this. I don't know which studies you're talking about, Sharon. Can you quote
a
study?
Alaska one. Okay, I'll have to go to some notes here because I can't remember all of them. But China took control of an opium addiction epidemic by enforcing tough laws and implementing effective educational programs.
You understand the history of China now.
Yes.
The British used opium to conquer that country and control it.
In the 1920s, cocaine and heroin were easily obtained in Egypt. A decade later, a massive abuse epidemic caused authorities to curtail the supply of these drugs. In Japan, in the 1950s, 500,000 Japanese were addicted to amphetamines. A national campaign to cut the demand and supply, along with stiff penalties for traffickers and users, reduced the number. The same plan was followed in the 60s for the heroin epidemic, and there are other countries.
Okay. Now, Sharon, that's good information and information that we need to get. I think the question here, though, is and it's a good question. But the point that I think they're trying to make is there are lots of problems that may be in excess of just more people using it. Do you see the crime problem being there in Alaska? I mean, was there more crime when more people were using it, or was there less crime?
As what we saw in Alaska is that there was more crime, and that's why the Alaskans revolted and went back and changed their laws.
Why would there be more crime? David?
Can you cite a study for that? Because I never heard one. I am relatively familiar with what happened in Alaska. As of the time when Alaska changed its law, marijuana use in Alaska was lower than in the rest of the United States, despite the fact that that's the one state where it was most legal. Now, I think that there was a tremendous media hype beating on the people of Alaska, people like Nancy Reagan and Bill Bennett telling them, you're the shame of America because you've allowed adults to make their own decisions up in this state. And I have never seen any study that shows crime went up in Alaska.
Okay, well, I think we need to address ourselves to that if it gets down to that. But at this point, we don't need to argue about whether crime did go up or did go down. The question is, and I ask this to you guys, let me first ask you, would you two guys concede that if certain drugs were decriminalized, that there is a possibility, and probably a good possibility, that drug usage would go up, at least initially?
There's a possibility, sure.
David? Possibility.
Okay.
We don't know.
All right. You guys would probably say almost assuredly, right?
Absolutely.
The gentleman over here said that probably would happen. Now, the question is, I think before us, would that increase activity in terms of usage, however, have a lowering effect on the other costs, such as law enforcement, such as crime, such as rapes, robberies, and everything else? And so let me first ask you guys, would you concede that that is at least a possibility? If it were not illegal, that there might be less crime attached to that particular part of your activities?
Well, the federal government only spends $4.9 billion on the enforcement of the drug laws, so it's not a big part of our federal budget. It's a minor, very minor part. The fact of it is that the impact on our society is huge, and we talk about a war, but we have never really mobilized to fight this war. We haven't built the law enforcement mechanisms. We haven't built the educational and treatment systems to really go all out as a society to try and reduce it.
We keep on throwing more and more money. We build more and more prisons. We've increased the prison population, and I think the numbers are, what, about 80% of the people behind bars today have some drug-related something in their background?
Well, 80% of the federal prisoners were using drugs when they committed their other types of crimes or were drug traffickers themselves. But the fact of it is that this population, if it is legalized or decriminalized, will have even greater access than it has now.
What do you mean? You'll put the drugstore people in jail?
It will send a signal to the young people of this nation that it's all right. And it's not all right. It's not all right from their personal health. It's not all right from the social cost. I don't want the children that are born to have drugs continually used in the womb so that these children start off addicted to drugs before they even have a right to make their own decision.
Okay, David, so you're signaling to them now that this is okay.
Well, I tried to answer this once. I don't think in a free society everything that's legal is okay. There are a lot of things that are legal in the United States that are not okay. It's not okay to lie to your wife. It's not okay to it's not a good idea to smoke cigarettes. I don't think people should probably read Hustler magazine. All of those things are legal. Now, the question is, do we have a society where absolutely everything that's bad is illegal? I don't think we do. I don't think we want that kind of society. But the question you asked was, even if there was some increased drug use, would that be offset by the other benefits? And I think it would. I think even if there was some increased drug use, a 50% reduction in crime rates in major cities would be a good way to offset that. 2/3 of the murders in Washington a couple of years ago were attributed to drugs. Now, I want to make a point. Not to the chemical effects of drugs. Not one murder in Washington. 2/3 of the murders in Washington are related to the black market. If you want to do something about the drug problem, take the profits out of it. Take the huge profits out of it that are bringing people in who are willing to do anything to get their hands on that kind of money.
Thanks.
I'm a little concerned as principal of an elementary school. We can see many, many more children being almost addicted to it when they're in the 4th, 5th, and 6th grade. And it's such a sad situation for all of us that we have to experience that kind of behavior in our schools. I think that I personally feel that if we could get to a point where we can clarify the different types of legal defense for many of the people, we might be able to stand a chance of helping the little ones. Now, somebody mentioned a while ago, some of those kids are they're already addicted to when they come to school. And we have to deal with brain disorder, we have to deal because of drugs. But not only that, in addition to that, because we have those habitual people already pushing this stuff. Now, you're talking about 13-year-olds. I had a 9-year-old who was dealing and pushing and getting the other kids to sell it, and he had a payroll of $600 a week.
Yeah, Lewis, now, I think your point is very well taken. I think what they said earlier, though, was simply this. Do you have pushers pushing beer and pushing wine in your schools?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes, sir.
So you have them buying it at the store and pushing it?
I don't know where they buy it, but I'm certain that they go to the store and buy it, but it's increasing the number of problems our children are facing.
You think they maybe steal it from their parents' liquor cabinet?
As a matter of fact, I had a child in the office the other day. He said, Daddy, if your mom do it, why can't I? And they had a bottle of tequila in school, drinking it, and they got it from mom and dad.
Well, that sounds like a real problem. It also sounds like a real mom and dad problem to me, doesn't it, to you? Okay. You've been very patient, sir. Go ahead.
My real concern is, Phil, is basically with some of the things that you said earlier and our statesman said about the economic impact of this. I'm a small contractor, and I approached the Counter-Narcotics Operations Division in the Pentagon and said, I have the way to stop the trafficking across the southern border dead. I can do that. Here's what we do. And that was the beginning of a 2.5-year travail that I've been begging Bucks folks to help me out with. But it seems that the laws don't protect small companies that can do that from the economic interests of those people. I'd like to have your comment about that.
I'm not sure that I grab. Are you talking about building some sort of barrier on the border?
Oh, no, sir. We have, with the current data linking and infrared systems and ability to communicate and use all of your databases simultaneously, the ability to put at your fingertips the ability to use your agents and the assets that you have a lot better. The question I have for the guy from the Cato Institute is principally, how are we going to handle the economic power that can essentially shut that kind of an initiative down by a small company? Because that's what they've done to us. I mean, that's the thing I'm worried about.
What economic power?
The economic power to be able to put down this kind of capability to stop it.
Are you talking about drug dealers?
I'm talking about whatever economic interests there are in Washington to continue this activity as opposed to funding Mr. Jordan and Mr. Revelle's organization to put a stop to this stuff.
Well, let me see if I understand exactly where you're coming from. Are you saying to us that you and your company have a solution which, if the DEA and the FBI decided to do something with it, would help solve and would help win the war on drugs?
In the Gulf War, we were able to fly 33,000 sorties with the F-16 using these kinds of technology items for the planning and the execution of those missions. We lost 6 airplanes. That's not ever been done in the history of warfare. That is the kind of technology that's available and not in use. These guys are using older systems. Their budgets do not permit the introduction of this technology. I know, because I'm very frustrated with that at the moment.
Okay, so let me follow up then the second question. Are you saying that if we had a few more government bucks to spend on it, they could come and buy your product, make some money for you, which we like, we're all capitalists here, I trust, but make some money for you, and are you saying that they are on purpose not wanting to buy high technology because they want to continue the war on drugs?
I am saying that there are interest groups around Washington that are very interested in promoting the point of view that we can handle this problem. Endorphins and enkephalins happen to match the OH radicals that come out of cocaine. So it's real close to something that's immediately addictive. What we don't have is we don't have the support for their agencies, as far as I'm concerned, to help do the restriction on the flow that we need.
Okay. Thanks. David, I think he's saying he's got a solution that's going to make them more powerful than they are right now.
Well, by my calculations, we arrest 1 million people a year in the drug war. We're spending $14 billion a year at the federal level. I think that's plenty. I think if you can't win a war on drugs with that kind of money and that kind of arrest record, it's a pretty good indication that you can't win it. We are spending 100 times, adjusted for inflation, what we spent to prosecute alcohol prohibition in the 1920s, and we couldn't win that war, and with 100 times more money, we're not winning this one. So I think the idea of thinking that you're going to stop all the drugs coming into this country is just crazy. Lots of stuff comes in here, and at the prices that we're allowing people to pay for drugs. If you stop every drug coming across this country, you can grow it in Texas, you can grow it in New York City.
Yes, the question I wanted to address was, it seems like we're talking a lot about interdiction and prosecution, you know, on this particular conversation we're having this evening. And I'd like to know, or I'd like to hear the panelists discuss the fact that most of the monies in going into the particular war on drugs are going into those particular areas, and what impact would be greater funding towards prevention of those particular behaviors.
If I may, we have never concentrated on prevention in a long, long time. The three areas in which law enforcement acts is interdiction, eradication, and street drug work. And they're failing in all these areas. It's sort of like fellas saying, you know, in baseball, you three strikes and you're out. It's not true with these fellas. They say, no, you just have to hit a little harder. Well, they can hit as hard as they want to, and they know they're not going to win this war.
But you, one of your solutions, would it be fair to say that one of your solutions is you would like to see them put more money into, or more money spent on prevention?
Well, they know that this money is going to have to come from law enforcement. It's going to have to come into treatment and prevention. And the way we do this is when we legalize something, we must be ready for any possible increase in usage.
Okay, I think you guys said earlier, correct me if I'm wrong, you'd like to see more money spent there, Phil?
Yes, you know, strong law enforcement with prevention, education, and treatment.
But we don't have that now.
That's what we've been...
Well, we've got some solutions there, and John, why don't you stand up here and tell us a bit about what your group is doing and how you're addressing this part of the issue.
Thank you. Good day, gentlemen. I think marijuana is the most dangerous drug on the streets today.
Why?
Because there are people like you that are giving information that is absolutely erroneous. I work with kids... Yeah. who are chemically dependent. Yeah. I'm telling you that the mean age of kids' first introduction to drugs, whether that drug be alcohol or marijuana, is tracking lower. That's a fact. Mm-hmm. Okay? Let's change the perspective and take a look at the war that we're this war that we're losing.
Yeah.
But just to say, would you agree that it's being lost or not?
No, at this point. Well, it's not lost yet, as long as we keep fighting. See, and if we stop fighting,
you hit harder.
then yeah, it will. And effectively, too. Mm-hmm. As far as prevention goes, the best prevention that I know of is that you take somebody who uses drugs, yeah, and you clean them up and you keep them clean. That is true prevention. That's
we all agree with that in the
truest word. There are kids today that I work with whose lives are saved because there's a criminal justice system and a consequence that they pay for their behavior that offers them the level of motivation required to be able to find recovery as in their own enlightened self-interest.
Are you saying that if we didn't have the criminal justice system with these kind of penalties, that they would not have any incentive to clean themselves up?
They would have one big powerful motivation diminished. To do that, you would tie my hands. Mm. Please.
I don't understand how we're tying your hands. What is your organization?
It's a program called Lifeway.
Oh, okay.
It's real simple. Mm-hmm. When you do something that
I
you're not...
I just didn't know what your organization...
Okay.
Is.
When you do something that you're not supposed to do, there's a consequence to mm-hmm. it, okay? Mm-hmm. To take away the consequences, to enfranchise what I consider deadly, unacceptable behavior. And understand that my perspective is with kids. Mm-hmm. Adolescents, mm-hmm. young adults, we've got to let them know that it's not okay to get high. And that we need to make it. And Mr. Boaz, I am impressed at the facts that you have at your fingertips. And I was sitting here, and I was in awe, and I was reminded there's a saying about there's something and statisticians. I can't remember exactly how that.
I think it's liars, damn liars, and statistics.
I'm glad you said it, not me. The point being is that the facts are is that more and more kids are getting involved. Latest study out shows that there's an increase of marijuana use from eighth graders on up. Those are the facts.
Yeah, for the first time, are you using statistics on us now? Or
I'm a damn liar, I guess.
Just wanted to figure out what category you were in, John.
Remember, we've turned the corner on the drug wars back in the 70s, in the early 80s, in the late 80s, in the 90s. We're right back where we started.
Okay, but the question
how
is,
many corners was that?
Yeah.
Did you the turning the corners with kids? I mean, it was never legal for kids anyway. And it got down not because you were putting the kids in jail, but because folks like you were doing a good job. Folks like Sharon were educating these folks.
Exactly. Okay.
Which is what I think everybody agrees to.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Let me get this gentleman who's right behind me, then I'll try to come over there to you in just a second.
Well, I guess my question would be to the law enforcement. I keep hearing about this war, and I'm wondering, where is it being fought? We were able to seal off the borders of a whole country, and we can't seal off 200 miles between Mexico and Texas. We have the technology to track airplanes all across the world, and we can't find a cargo plane coming in loaded with drugs. Ships are coming to our shores every day full of drugs, and we can't find them. We don't have a drug problem in our neighborhoods. We have a problem with drugs. Anyone in this room can walk or drive through our neighborhoods, put $10 in their hand, and stick it out the window, and somebody will put some crack in it, and yet the police can't find them. So what I'm saying is, where are you fighting this war? Because we would like to get involved.
Okay, well, he's throwing the gauntlet down. Gentlemen?
Well, obviously the federal government is only part of the enforcement effort, the police departments, the sheriff's offices, and so forth. But I can guarantee you that we have inundated the courts with major trafficking groups and organizations. We have more people in prison today for drug trafficking, not use, but drug trafficking, than at any time in our history. And there are many more out there. But the nation itself has never really come to grips with the amount of effort that we're going to have on all aspects of this. We're going to have to be able to shut off those borders, and we've never done that. We're going to have to pay some diplomatic consequences if we do that, because obviously other types of goods and products are going to be slowed down if we have a very vigorous effort at the borders. We're also going to have to look at the homegrown variety, the home-produced variety of synthetic drugs, methamphetamines, and marijuana that can be produced here. All of our drug problem doesn't come from overseas. So there's a lot more that needs to be done before we really have an all-out effort. Americans spent $4 billion betting on the Super Bowl. We only spend $4.9 billion per year on the federal law enforcement effort.
I guess I have one follow-up question. Is a few years ago, we went to a country and practically invaded it to get a drug law, and yet we can't get a dope deal out of New York. And I got a serious problem with that. I mean, we can read about all of the drug families, and we know all of these people, but nobody gets arrested. I mean, one or two gets arrested because it hits the headlines. But if this is a war, we surely are ill-prepared. Or we don't have the guts to win it. I guess that's probably part of our problem. We don't want to win this war because I don't think we're fighting it.
Well, I've got agents. Phil's got agents out on the streets right now every day that are fighting this war. And they're fighting it against some very vicious and very heavy armed people. They're out there engaged. I was out on arrest the other day of a Mexican mafia group that has committed a number of murders and carrying out moving drugs into the Hispanic community. We've had joint operations with the police all across North Texas, and this is amplified across the entire country. We are engaged. It's just more of them than there are of us, and we don't have all the resources to fight the war.
Yeah, and Phil, a couple of things that we've discussed before. We're here in Texas taping this program, but obviously the question that was asked before was, because of the effect that you're having in some areas, let's say Florida as an example, perhaps California, do you find more drugs coming through this part of the country as a result of that?
Right. By the way, we target the hierarchy type organizations, the cartels, the godfathers of the drug trade. That's what we do very effectively. We have one of our leading prosecutors here in the audience. We call it the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. That's what we target from the federal level. And as the pressure gets on in Florida or Houston, as you saw by a significant drug bust that came down here not too long ago, the traffickers realign themselves. But yes, we focus on, at the federal level, at the DEA, we have 3,500 agents fighting this drug war. worldwide. So ultimately, to win the war, we need to change the attitudes, the prevention and education. Law enforcement, as Buck said earlier, we're only a holding action. We need the help of the American people to win this war.
Okay, and that's what you're really asking for on this program, and I think these gentlemen who are here are obviously interested in it, and the kinds of things that you guys are doing, I think he's saying do more of it yourself, too. I think you are.
I have a real concern. I'm about sick of politics and bureaucracy. I'm tired of hearing, some of y'all sound like politicians, like you're getting ready to run for office. I'm wondering if some of you all, it's obvious you guys that have FBI and the drug enforcement, you all have been out there. But for us, myself and Mr. Grant and others that have smaller programs that really see it happening, the bottom line is we are out there every day. We have some ideas on how the drug war can be solved to a certain extent, but it seems as though you all that read a lot of these books, that sit behind the desk, that don't get out there and really find out what's going on, you get up here on the stage and you come up with these stats and everything, and it doesn't resolve anything. My concern is, what are you going to do after you compile all those stats? Are you going to get from behind the suits and ties and get out there and get involved and put aside all the politics like you're running for office and all the bureaucracy?
Okay, good question. I don't know all these guys real well, but I know them a little bit. And I don't think there's a politician among them, even though I may be wrong.
No,
Dean Colvin, go ahead.
But let me say something in this regard. While this war is being fought, many of the government agencies are fighting exactly the things that they're working for. CIA is a good example. The State Department is a good example. They had an agreement in the Bahamas between the drug dealers and the Bahamian government. They were about to say, you can bring in drugs and we'll protect you. Could the DEA do anything about that? No, because the State Department put a lid on it. And the CIA, when Noriega was in power, they were about to move in on Noriega. And again, the higher-ups put a lid on it. This is just the tip of the iceberg. The CIA has been, God knows what sins they have involved themselves in. They have stopped many of the programs that these agents have been trying to do overseas.
So a couple of things. You're saying that, first of all, there are government agencies that are a part of the problem allow the people to do their job.
Secondly,
you're saying that perhaps decriminalizing some of these drugs would get rid of the operations of some of these drug lords that you're talking about. So there are two ways of looking at that.
That's correct.
Hi, my name is Angela Davis, and I work for the Dallas County Sheriff's Department. And I think it's real important that we stop only looking at this as a legal issue. And the reason why I said we're looking at it as a legal issue, because that's where we're putting the money. It is a social and economic issue. If we really want to help people, we've got to start looking at it like that and being willing to put the money in it. You can't stop someone from using drugs, whether it's legal or illegal. They're going to use it if they don't feel like they have some options. And until we start looking at what you're doing, we've agreed it's not working, but are you going to keep on going in that direction? Yes, you've already agreed on that. We need to start from the beginning, because what we're doing is not working. I don't care how many prisons you build, you're going to keep them full.
Thanks for those comments. Appreciate that.
My name is Ricky Clark, and I'm with the Texas War on Drugs. My comment, I'm in concurrent with what you're saying. What I like to hear is, what are some of the solutions on why they're using the drugs? We never talked about why they use drugs anyway. Whether you legalize it or don't legalize it, why they're doing it. And you're talking about in reference to the seller of the drugs, it's an economic problem, not just a drug problem.
Thanks. Yes, please, stand up.
My name is Rose Romero, and I'm a prosecutor with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I prosecute many of these major drug organizations that Mr. Jordan was talking about. But what I did last week was I went out and I substitute taught at an eighth grade class in a very poor part of Dallas. And I did that as a program with the Dallas Bar Association, and it was an eighth grade class. And in that class, Mr. Bowes, were children, eighth graders, that were so high on drugs, they couldn't possibly learn how to read or how to write. And what you're advocating is a band-aid to this problem. Let them all do it. It's a band-aid, Mr. Bowes. The problem is why is that child taking or using drugs? He needs to learn how to read, he needs to learn how to write, and he needs to become a taxpayer in this country so that he can add something to this community. Because if you're going to allow them to do that, what drugs do to you, it doesn't only make you feel good. What it does is it degrades you morally and personally, and slowly, little by little, if we decriminalize any of those drugs you're talking to, our country will be degrading just as well.
Okay, can I answer something here?
And David, I'm going to give you an answer to an opportunity, obviously, to respond to that, but I don't know about you. I would hate to be on the witness. I would hate to be the defendant and have her argue in front of the jury, because she is obviously very powerful with what she says. Go ahead.
The thrust of every question that's been asked from the prosecutor, the school principal, the people who work with drug affected kids, is that what we're doing isn't working, that prohibition is not stopping eighth graders and sixth graders from using drugs. Now, where I come from, when what you're doing isn't working, you do something different. And all anybody is talking about, it seems to me, is let's just do more of what isn't working. Everybody keeps saying it's getting worse. The drugs are getting stronger. The kids are getting younger. And all we want to do is do more of it. I think that's crazy. Somebody said, the definition of insanity is to keep doing more of what you've been doing when it's been failing. Now, Buck's got some ideas for what we should do. We should step this up and step this up and step this up and step this up and spend more taxpayers' money. And I just want to ask one question. Buck, we can't keep drugs out of prisons. What are you going to do to a free society that'll make it tighter than a prison?
Well, in fact, we can keep drugs out of prisons.
Well, you haven't done it yet.
Oh, yes, we have. And we have also taken a number of cases. You can find in the federal prison system, they are very different than many of your state prisons, because we do have vigorous enforcement and we do prosecute any individual who introduces contraband into those facilities. We simply can't give up and say, well, because it's difficult, we're not going to fight. The fact of it is, we haven't even started to fight. My whole point is,
arrests a year isn't
starting. A million
starting?
Arrests, you are mixing people that are picked up on the streets for possession as opposed to drug traffickers, as opposed to those who are selling drugs, not just those who are using them.
But it's still a million drug arrests.
Well,
that's a lot of arrests.
But they never even get processed through the system. Certainly we need to be more focused and more targeted on our approach. But the fact of it is that none of us in law enforcement are going to say that we have the final solution. We are part of that solution, but it's got to be on changing societal attitudes.
And, okay.
But if we stop doing what we're doing, societal attitudes are never going to change, because we're going to be inundated.
Okay, Buck, we have time for just one short question here, then we're going to have to try to wrap this up.
Actually, I didn't really have a question. I'd like to say something to people who were asking why the kids start using drugs. I'm a recovering addict. I'm getting on to a year sober. If we want the main way to stop all this is the prevention, is what I believe. The only way that we can prevent any of this is starting as soon as kids are born. I started drinking when I was in fifth grade. And that's just, that's unreal. The reason why I started doing that, I didn't like my life. You're going to have a lot of kids that don't like what's going on, that aren't happy at home, that have incredibly low self-esteem. What happens when I got high, I felt great and I had friends. That's the main thing that I believe that we need to be focusing on.
Let me ask you, would you, sure, go ahead and clap. On the issue of whether you could better control this and deal with people such as yourself, are we better off making enforcement even more and more difficult, as they're trying to do now, by spending more money on it? Or should we decriminalize it, or even at least look at a study of possibly legalizing some of these drugs, in your opinion?
I think we should definitely study it. I think either way it goes. I think if we decriminalize it, probably what's going to happen is we're going to have a major increase, and then all the drug addicts are going to end up killing themselves off.
That may be a solution right there. Who knows? Okay. We only have a very short period of time left. Let me ask each of you, to the viewers who are watching this program, what would you have them do specifically? The people who are sitting at home watching this program, and Dean Colvin, let me start with you. Just give me about 15 seconds.
Well, what Rose was talking about, that really got to me because, you know, they tell me, people that are much smarter than I, that what a child learns until the age five is going to determine what is going to happen to him a great deal for the rest of his life. And that's
where it
means
has to
begin.
That
whatever we do in regard to decriminalization, we must have treatment programs
work
with
David,
these people.
Very quickly.
We need strong families and strong community organizations and strong churches, but what we don't need is to pour more money into a failing law enforcement program. There's no light at the end of that tunnel.
Okay, law enforcement is not failing. What we're saying here is that we need strong law enforcement with prevention and education, very strong programs along those lines, including treatment.
Buck, we're out of time, and so I'm going to cut your remarks off, if I may.
I just say we need a holistic approach. It's not one simple solution.
Thank you. An economist named Tom Sowell put it this way. He said that policies are judged by their consequences, but crusades are judged by how good they make the crusaders feel. And I think that all of us, in fact, are crusaders in this. The question is, what should we be crusading about? It's up to you. It's up to all of you to determine that crusade. But whatever it is, be in the crusade. As always, we've been talking about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.